Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisor of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch, where each week Ben and I bring you the insider's guide to property investing. Hello, mate.
G'day, mate. How are you going?
Very good. You just got off a plane today and you got a sore back. How did that go?
Next question. We were not talking about back pain anymore.
I know, but I was talking about the plane ride, mate. Showing some care.
It's tough. It's not going well, but no. You know, I have good and bad hours.
We might have some listeners who are back surgeons, if they could just ride into Ibis.
You know what? Well, actually, we did. You've got a good segue there. I had Kent reach out to me in Sydney. He's got a hyperbaric chamber business out of Sydney, and he was telling me that it would assist with my recovery. So here's a shout out to Kent. What a great thing for someone, one of our listeners, to just come to us and basically say, come and I want to fix your back, come and see me. So his business is called Heal It. The website, I think, is healit.com.au. It's out of Sydney. So, you know, a little shout out to him. We don't receive anything.
Cash for comment there?
No, for comment. I don't get paid. I can't go and see him. But he's been really nice. I reached out to him and said, thanks very much. And he's given me a few little exercises and things for the car and a few other things to try and get my back good. So thank you very much, Kent. Very kind of you.
So you're in Sydney today? You just sort of popped into the chamber today?
I could have popped into the chamber, but no, I had to get back here because we've got a very special guest today.
We do. I'm exceptionally excited. We'll go there shortly. But quickly before we do, Ben, we'll go into the mindset minute.
Sounds like a plan.
Today, I'm going to talk about don't compare your behind the scenes with someone else's highlight reel.
Do tell.
Well, if you think about the fact that we've got so much comparison going on now with Instagram and Facebook, and the thing is that, you know, I'm an Instagram husband, right? So whenever we have a meal, I'm not allowed to eat first. I've got to take a photo of it first so my wife can put it up on her Instagram page.
Right.
I'm sure you love that.
Luckily, I didn't pay out. If people send me another photo of something they're eating, I mean, really? I'm not there.
She's into whole food. I get that. I understand. But it's very easy to compare what happens up on social media. That's their highlights reel. That's the best of the best.
Totally.
And we're in our mind and we're thinking about what's going on, which is our behind the scenes.
Yep.
So I think it's very important. But what's the context for our
podcast? Well, you say that. I mean, Trevor Hendy's big on that stuff too. I absolutely think everyone thinks that everyone's going along beautifully if they look at everyone's Facebooks and social media stuff. But, you know, we all have our challenges. We all have our, you know, hard bits that we've got to get through.
We do. No one puts the photo up when they're in their tracker dacks.
No. But, well, I do, but that's another story.
Actually, there was last week, Ben, in his tracky dacks
on the podcast.
Remember, in his...
You could have cropped it a little bit higher.
You're like magic. Don't worry, mate. But obviously, the context when it comes to property investing is the people who look the wealthiest are often the ones who aren't.
Mm.
So don't compare your highlights reel, their highlights reel, with your behind the scenes. So something for us to think about today.
But, I like it a lot.
Mate, let's get into it. We've got a very special guest, a very, very humble lady. I'm sure she doesn't like all the fuss that we're making, but Jan Summers, who I have wanted to have on the couch for a very long time.
Anyone who's read the book will know Bryce's story of how he got into property investing.
Building Wealth Through Investment Property. Jan Summers released this in the early 90s. I read it. I saw Jan. I saw you on the Today Show. It was back in 1993, first year uni. I remember you were up on the whiteboard with Ray Martin. Do you remember that?
I do. That was many years ago.
And you were playing with numbers, drawing houses, and you just said, there's some tax help, and you can buy properties and you make some money. And I looked at that and I went, why isn't everyone doing this? And I didn't understand mindset back then because it just seemed to me that everyone
should be doing it. Or money management.
But welcome to the couch.
Thank you very much. I have to admit that being introduced as a humble lady is a much better introduction than last Sunday when I was in a triathlon and I was introduced as the oldest competitor.
Well, you are in terrific shape. I mean, you mentioned you're up at 5 a.m. this morning swimming. I wasn't even up at 5 a.m. I was up at 6, but so you keep active?
Yes, I try to. Yes, you have to make a habit of it. Every day I do something.
Yeah, and have the triathlon go?
Well, when you're the only one in it over 65, you have to win it. You've only got to finish it to win it.
I think starting it is a terrific effort. How many triathlons have you done?
I actually have done an Olympic sized triathlon. That's another story for another day. Mm. I've done a couple in the past life, but that was pre-back.
Yeah.
You know, now I try and hit golf balls and try and, you know, snow skip, but that's even potentially, you know, maybe
that's out now.
Pre-back as well. Yeah. So we'll have to wait and see. Anyway, enough about us. I'm really keen to sort of unpack your story, Jan, in terms of how you've been able to get to what you've done and how you stumbled across property, or did you stumble across it? I mean, what I love about your work ethic, like, you know, your health and well-being and fitness, you're still doing that now. And ultimately, you know, you had a lot of drive to be able to do this, you know, in the property space as well, didn't you?
Well, yes. And I think the longevity of what I do is simply about, I've done the same thing for 45 years. There's been no change of story. There's no change of scenery, depending on the circumstance, depending on the economic climate. We started buying property back in December of 1972, and we had the same formula of borrow, buy and keep ever since. Not that I knew what I was doing back then. It was probably 10, 12 years later when I understood what the formula was about. The only reason we accumulated property in the beginning was because I was pretty miserly, and anything we bought, we hung on to because we didn't know any different, really. It was the same as accumulating shoes or accumulating old clothes. We accumulated property because we lived in 10 houses in the first 10 years that we were married. Not that we bought 10 houses in the first year, but it was a starting point. Buy and keep. Oh, we're moving on. Okay, we'll keep that one and rent it out. Oh, we're moving on again. Okay, we'll keep that one and rent it out, and so on and so on. But it was a long time later before I realised what we'd done was kind of special.
Yeah. Well, you say it so flippantly now, but back then that was well and truly not the norm. I mean, who did you use as your mentor or the person that you took your advice on to keep them?
There was nobody really, and my advice to people these days, if you've got more than a couple of properties, you know more than anybody else about anything else.
Yeah.
So back then there was no accountants to talk to, there was no real estate agents who knew anything about keeping property, except it was a real estate agent back in 82, that was 10 years after we bought our first property, who finally told me that what I had was the basis for something huge. And it took a long time for that to sink in, and it was 3 or 4 years later that we actually took up his suggestion of borrowing and buying and keeping. It came about when we went to Sydney for the second time, 1981 or thereabouts, and I thought, well, we've been here a second time, it might be a good idea to buy some property. Now, back then, property was about, can you believe, about $50,000, which was twice as expensive as a property in Sydney, in Brisbane, which was about $25,000. No can do. The only way I thought that we could do it was to sell what we had and buy something else. So I went with my hands under my chin and in a bit of despair. I had a chat to an agent, and I was pregnant at the time and didn't have a job, and we had a single income and we were renting. So you can imagine fronting up to an agent, very pregnant, not having a job, single income, and we're looking to buy a property in Sydney. Not only that, we never had any money in the bank. So after rattling on for a few minutes, the agent listened to me, and I thought he was about to give me the flick, and we talked a little bit more, and he said, oh, so you've got a few properties in Brisbane. I said, yes, we own quite a few of them outright. Oh. Well, he said, lady, with what you've got in Brisbane, you can probably afford to buy half of Sydney. Okay. So I go home and tell my husband. I said, there's an agent who's just told me a story, and he said that we could probably buy half of Sydney. Oh, really? He said. Oh, okay. So this went on for a few years. It just took a long time to gel, and it was actually 4 or 5 years later in 86, 87, at a time when no one was buying property because we just had a global financial crash of the share market in late 87.
Yep.
And here I am wanting to go out and buy half of Brisbane, which we did.
Mm.
Not quite half, but it was quite
Sydney
a few
or
properties.
Brisbane?
No, we were back in Brisbane at that
you're back,
stage.
Okay, right, yeah.
The northern half or the southern half?
Yeah, well, the southern half.
Yeah.
And it just... how come nobody's buying any property? And then, at the time, they had just reintroduced negative gearing that was in abolition between 85 and 87.
Yeah.
We'd already bought quite a few by then, by that turn. Well, the day after the announcement, why aren't these real estate agents flooded?
Mm.
Where is everybody?
Yeah.
Where is everybody? So we had a ball. Properties were cheap, rents were sky high because no one was buying property, and they were all cash positive without me even trying.
Mm.
So Jan, did you only take one loan for each property at a time, or were you doing multiple loans at the same time before you had that meeting or that encounter with the real estate agent?
Well, at the time I was taking individual loans and trying to keep each property separated.
Yep, okay.
It wasn't until I used multi-properties as the collateral for certain lines and it just became a crossword jungle of this loan was held by the security of these properties and that loan was held by the security of those properties and then that loan was, it became a nightmare and today it still is a jumble.
Yep.
But it worked and the basic principle was to hold on to those properties without ever selling and use the security of those properties to then borrow against to buy even more.
Hmm. Yeah, that's brilliant.
So tell us a bit about the mindset back then, because you mentioned no one was buying. Having that much debt is something, there was a generation of pay cash for everything, pay any debts off as quickly as you can, and here you were getting yourself into more and more debt. So
yes. Well,
where did the determination come from?
Well, we had been brought up with the idea that you don't borrow money. If you can't afford a car, you don't go and borrow for it. If you can't afford a new lounge, you don't go and borrow for it. So that was a very good upbringing. But I had worked out for myself, I'm sure other people had discovered it before me, that borrowing to buy an asset that was going to continue to appreciate in value was okay to do. And so the question I asked myself was, well, if I'm going to borrow to buy for these properties, I need to ask myself, what have I got to show at the end of, say, 10 years for what I've borrowed this money for? And the answer was obvious because we had already been doing it for 10 years. The answer was obvious. We had borrowed money, although it was a principal and interest loan or multiple principal and interest loans over a long period of time that we had accumulated. But the terms of the loans was very short. Mm. It was sometimes 10 years. And so we were cash poor, paying out all of this money, all of this principal and interest. And of course, we had a lot to show for what we had borrowed to buy because we'd been paying it off at the rate of knots.
Mm.
So that was a critical question. What have you got to show for what you've borrowed your money for? And if you've bought a car or you've had a holiday or you've bought a boat or a caravan, at the end of 10 years, you've got to pay someone to take away your junk.
Yeah.
So the answer became very clear. I had answered that question myself. Yes, after 10 years, we bought our property in 72, and in 82, hey. And in 92, hey, my little $12,000 7.4 square property, which I still have today, or we still have today, is worth probably
$400,000.
Not a lot, not a lot, but when you've got lots of these little blighters, it adds up.
Now, the gearing ratio, I'm keen to understand how, you know, obviously with 10-year principal and interest loans, obviously the commitment that you have to keep making being short terms. I mean, obviously we know today we've got 30-year loan terms, what, interest-only periods. Did you have a rough idea what sort of global loan-to-value ratio you were running across your portfolio at any time?
To be safe, I tried to keep it at about a loan of about 60 to 70% of our total assets. I always kept a couple of properties that were totally free so that if I was being pressured, then I had something up my sleeve. I made sure that by that stage I'd switched to interest-only loans because I realised that the answer to borrowing more money was all about cash flow.
Yes.
So we switched to interest-only. And that reduced the pressure on the cash flow enormously and allowed us to borrow a lot more. So in the early days, I kept it at about 60 to 70%. I made sure 2/3 of those loans were fixed and at least a third was on a credit line variable rate, so that if interest rates rose, which they did in the early 90s to almost 20%,
yes.
Well, we were covered. Even though I was paying 16% at the time, there was no skin off my nose because we had a controllable debt. Mm. And that's the secret, to have a controllable debt.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, you said in your book, residential property, property finance and kept long-term is a wonderful investment. Is this still true?
Yes, it's been true for forever. Probably, I read a story about Cassius Cassatus. I probably haven't said his name correctly. He was doing it in Roman times. Mm-hmm. He would go trot off to the moneylenders and borrow a lot of money and buy a lot of property. And he was a little bit naughty because he also had a building team that was into renovations. And occasionally, he burnt down a few properties so that it could go and re-renovate them all and get the tenants out. Well,
so he could improve his yield.
Yes.
That is brilliant. Don't go and do that, listeners.
He was, I think, alleged to have caused or started the fire back in Nero's time, specifically to benefit from his properties. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But it makes a good story.
Yeah, we know a few people who have burnt places down in stock take sort of language, don't we? You know, there's comments around that as well.
You're a pioneer as a property investment educator in this country. Do you feel that true?
No, not really. There were people who did go before me who probably made a lot more money out of property, but it was not made publicly available. You never knew what people did, and it wasn't the sort of thing that you talked about at a dinner party.
Yeah,
even today, you don't talk about religion or politics or money.
Yeah.
And you don't sit down and make comparisons about my favourite politician is better than yours and I've got more houses than you. They're several no-nos. So there were people before, but I was probably one of the first to document it in an understandable way that people could take the recipe and go and make their own Christmas cake.
Brilliant.
Does that legacy, how does that legacy make you feel? Because I was chatting to the guys in our team here that you were coming in today, and they were, Jen Summers, she's in the building. I mean, every person involved in property investment has read her book. We've got them on the desk here. They're staples.
We still get feedback. I still get a lot of feedback. I had just a wonderful letter just the other day from someone who just retired to Peridgian, who probably saw that same show in 92,
yeah,
93.
Yeah.
And he's retired up there, and he told me in great deal what properties he had. And it's just a wonderful feeling. I say, well done, and it's just a shame that more people don't follow that recipe, but...
Hmm. Well, the reality is not everyone can. I mean, we can't have every Australian investing in property. But I want to come back to what you were saying about the dinner party, about talking about money. Do you still think that that should be a taboo topic? Like, are you... I mean, I think if we start openly talking about money, not about bragging about wealth, but certainly teaching people how to handle money and what you were talking about, it's all through your books around appreciating assets versus depreciating cars, all those types of examples. Do you feel that there's a message there that we still need to contribute?
There is, but if I'm asked, I will give honest answers and I will sprout a little bit, but I never initiate the conversation.
Yeah.
Because then I don't actually have a barrow to push, because I don't sell finance and I don't sell property and I don't sell Amway and I don't sell anything else. So I don't have a barrow to push, and I don't stand there and try to sprout. But if I'm asked a question, add on a bedroom to our three-bedroom house, because the agent said we'll get more. Oh, well, what for? Well, I'll get more rent. Well, okay, now how much is it going to cost? Oh, well, it'll cost a few $1,000s. I said, well, think of a figure and then treble it, and that's how much it's going to cost. And are you going to get that money back over a short period of time? Because I could probably go around to all my properties and add a bathroom and add a bedroom and add a patio and add a deck, and sure, it'll get more rent. Of course it will get more rent, but will it make me any more money relatively? Yes, it's a bit like adding an ashtray to the back of a motorbike is how I describe it. Not necessary.
Oh, very good.
Now, you, because you're the original independent voice in Australia with that, because on your website it says, you know, whilst many organisations use our material to assist their clients with investment in property, our company is completely independent and does not sell property finance or even personal advice. Were you ever tempted?
I'd actually became a mortgage broker in the very early years. Mm. That was back in the late 80s.
Mm, when you would have been a pioneer as a mortgage broker at that time, too.
You could go and get a licence just by filling in a form and saying that you'd never had a criminal conviction and here's your certificate and off you go. And it was very easy for me to work at that because I had three very young children at home. At that stage, they were probably 6, 4 and 2. But I could only get to one person at a time, and one person was taking up an hour of my time, and I felt I had more to offer. I felt I had more to offer, and I had accumulated a lot of knowledge at that stage. And so I thought, I'll just put that aside. I don't need to go down that track. Of course, I could see myself getting drawn into, okay, you want to get a financial product through this particular financier, well, we'll give you this percent as a kickback and a tail and a trial and everything else. No, I don't really want that because then I'm influenced by what I would do for people. So I put together a little manual. This is in the late 80s. It was a 56-page manual that I still have got a couple of dinosaur relics of. And it just outlined the principle. And we printed it ourselves. My husband typed because at that stage I couldn't type. I remember I liked typing the word property because the E-R-T-Y was
on the line.
And I could do that very quickly. And people were very interested, and it just virtually sold out the back of a car. And I did a few seminars at that stage, and people liked it. It was a very simple formula. It was just like selling a cookbook. And I thought, well, okay, I'll just take even more time off. I've got kids at home running around, and I knew I had a good formula. So that's how the first book came about. I wrote it, I researched it. I was fairly good at researching. That was probably my strength back then, was to research and understand how things had happened. That year, I had a book, and I thought, oh, what am I going to do with it? Most people do it the other way around. Here's an advance, go away and hide yourself and put a book together. But I put a book together all under our own steam. I had it printed, and I think I had about 5,000 to 10,000 books printed back in the end of 92. Well, what am I going to do with it? And so people like Penguin and
who were some of the other publishers,
Wiley?
There was a few publishers.
Wiley would have been around then, I don't think, was it?
Quite a few publishers I approached. Oh, no, like, you know, who are you? Well, I'm just me. Like,
Just done it.
Yeah.
I've actually the proof.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I said it's a real, very well-written book because I was very pedantic, as I am with my properties, about making sure that every time you turned a page, there's a heading, and making sure that things kind of had a nice pattern, like it was a very easy to follow recipe. Oh no, we're not worried about how it looks. And I said, it's on good quality paper. No, we don't care how it feels either. It's got to be a good seller. So I trotted along to a little known distributor called Heron, who'd been around for a long time, and I had to chat the fellow there, and he said, well, you'll have to employ a publicist. I said, I don't need any publicity. He said, if I'm going to take the book, yes, you do. So I did find a publicist, and Colleen McSween was extremely good. She was, I don't mind giving her a plug, she was from the Image Bureau, and she said...
She hit you on the Ray Martin show?
She did.
She's brilliant then.
she was very good. She says there's got to be an order of things, and I said I don't really need to do all of these things. I just want the book to sell. Well, no, it doesn't quite work like that. So she had a plan, and she said, "Well, we've got to give you a label." I said, "I don't need a label. I'm just me. I'm just a housewife." She said, "Well, that's the label." That's the label. That's the housewife. Well, that's fine. I can live with that. I don't need to be a guru or an expert, but a housewife I can live with.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to my don't let your behind the scenes impact the highlights reel. You were just the real. There was no highlights reel. It was just exactly who you were.
Full of substance. That's you know, and authentic and full of substance.
Now, you mentioned that you were the housewife. What about the husband? Was Ian on board early, or did you have to
not at that stage. Now, Ian is a research scientist, or was a research scientist with CSIRO, and he was a prawn expert. Mm-hmm. He was one of the first into computers. We used to travel around university in the late 60s with a card full of Fortran cards, because Fortran was the language at the time. And we couldn't disturb. We had suitcases full of these cards, all in a nice little order. And so he was one of the first computing gurus, and he used to crunch numbers for prawns, particularly in the Gulf of Carpentaria, where he helped establish the fishery up there. So after he helped me assemble the books and he helped edit it, he was very good at editing because he'd edited a lot of research documents. And I said, I think, look, this is how the numbers work. You've got to put in a few figures for a property. You put in its price and its rent and how much interest you're paying and how much rent you're getting and how much tax you're paying and what depreciation. And the bottom line should be, this property is going to cost me, say, $40. And there'll be a return on my money. Because I had done a little bit of mathematics at university. I wasn't very proficient, but I did.
You're a school teacher.
I did. That doesn't mean that you know everything. It just means you can teach everything, but you don't have to know everything. So I played with these figures, and I produced a spreadsheet, and I put it in front of his nose, and I said, I want you to turn this little Excel spreadsheet into a proper software program, which he did. So he had his normal work.
And that's the origins of the
And that was the origin of the property investment analysis software.
PIA software, which is still available for sale
it's
today.
It's still available.
You can check it out. What's the best way? I want to do a big plug for this.
Yes, our website.
We obviously, you know, our business has a copy of it. We've been subscribing to it for many years.
We'll put it on the show notes.
Yep, we'll definitely put it on the show notes and a link to it, because it is fantastic if you want to analyse a property in regards to your personal circumstances. It's a must-have for any DIY.
He still tinkers with it. He still plays with it. He still updates it.
Yeah,
still
we see the upgrades come through every now and then.
And we both work from home. I do a lot of the property side, and I do a lot of the renovating side, and organise a lot of tradesmen. I do not manage the properties. I don't do that. But he still tinkers with the software. So at 5 o'clock, he's like, I'm just going up to have a shower before we have dinner. Well, okay. Well, an hour later, I said, where are you? Oh, I just had these few things to fix up on the software. So now my traditional line is, when you go and have a shower, don't stop at the office on the way back.
So he's detail-oriented. He loves
the figures. He loves the numbers crunching.
Is he paralysis analysis? I mean, when you were making those first decisions to buy, was he all on board, or were you having
him? he was totally on board, because together we had seen what had happened in the last 10 years. And so we had been part of that team together where we had struggled to buy property, but because of the high principal and interest loan over the 10 years, he had seen the effect and what it was doing. And then together we just progressed. We progressed as a team, so he understood it all. And probably I was a bit of the gung-ho element, as I am today. This kitchen needs renovating. Oh, well, where do we start? Well, all we do is get a chisel and you knock off the bench and do this and that and that, and he'll come in and we'll do it all. But I'm certainly not the expert in that. I was a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none, but I learned to ask a lot of people along the way. Things that after that real estate agent had explained, I thought, there are still a lot of people out there who know more than I ever did. I was just able to pull it all together and explain it to people in a simple way.
So, Jan, you started in 72. That was the first...
Yes, that was the first property.
And so you had double household income at that point, were you?
School
teaching, and he was working CSIRO. Ian was with CSIRO.
Yes.
So that first 10 years, you had the benefit of two household incomes.
Not for 10 years. Yep. No. In 72, it was the end of 72, I started teaching through 73. I did teach, I didn't teach for 74, 75, because we were in Sydney, and I was just the copy lady. If you wanted anything photocopying, I did it.
Yep.
So I was just the gopher, go for this and go for that. And Then I did teach full time between 76 and 80.
Yep.
And we did acquire quite a few properties then. But between 80, I went back teaching.
Yep.
I had wanted to, but the system had changed. I couldn't deal with the discipline or the lack of discipline that was in the schools in those days. And so, and I was a stay-at-home mum for 7 years between 82 and 88, 89.
Just buying your property along the journey.
Just buying property along the way. With and most of that property was bought in that period of time on a single income.
Mm. Yeah, wow. And I think that's good for the listeners to understand. So, you know, when you first start out, we want to know, okay, well, how are you doing this? So
with three children.
Three children. Obviously, we were getting properties that were close to neutrally geared. With a LVR of 60 to 70% with depreciation, they would have been pretty, you know, quite conservative in regards to the yield that you were getting at the time. You mentioned higher rents.
Yes.
And obviously then you add your incomes on top of that, allows that to take place.
But I must say, it wasn't as though each property was geared 60 to 7%.
Yes.
It was the total portfolio that was 60 to 70%.
Yep.
Each property we bought after... Even 85. Actually, quite a few properties were bought in 85 with a gearing ratio of like 110%, because by then I'd worked out how to borrow the costs and everything else.
What year did you work that out?
Well, that was what the agent explained to me back in 83. So it was 3 years after that.
Yeah. So 86, you started to gear up.
To start, yes.
And that's the... Sorry, you go, mate.
No, I'm fascinated by mindset. So do your parents live in Queensland, around you?
Yes.
So were they giving you any taps on the shoulder?
No.
Too much debt?
Well, not as far as the property is concerned, but we did have a very strong background in how to manage money, how to save. I mean, I walked down here for this interview this afternoon and I can't help but stop at the op shop that's 20 metres up the road.
Street up there, yeah.
I said humble.
Do you think that's... So you've obviously created a significant level of wealth. I have heard that the only sort of luxury you give yourself is a business class airfare if you're flying to
Europe. That's right.
But that's all about comfort, and I get that as someone with a bad back. I absolutely get that. Do you feel that there is a need? I mean,
I don't feel that need to drive a Rolls Royce or to buy the latest Picasso. I never did feel that need. There's a few luxury items I might buy. I treat myself to a pair of running shoes.
I might buy them
three or four at a time. I still drive a 13-year-old BMW that I bought secondhand. I just love it to death. I can't get rid of it. The leather is scratched to pieces either through dogs or because I throw my bike in the back when I'm off to do a triathlon.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't have that need, but there's certain things. I like nice appliances and I like a nice property with a nice view, and those things are important to me. But not to wearing a $200,000 Gucci watch or, you know, it might be a $50 swatch. And that's about it. But that doesn't mean all people have to live like that. But sometimes you can't have your cake and eat it too. Mm. And when you're starting off, there's got to be some kind of limitation. As I say, it's a cross between living in a palace and a tent. You'll find a balance and you don't have to live like a pauper for that accumulation phase.
Well, there's plenty of studies to show that once you can reach, I think it's once you get to sort of minimum $50,000, there's no sort of increased happiness just come from the extra income that you've got. Once your basic needs have been met.
I think that security provides you with that happiness. That's what gives you the happiness, just the security to know you can do this if you want to, you can buy that if you need to.
So if we were to ask your kids in terms of when they were growing up, did they feel like they ever missed out on anything, do you think, if you asked them that question?
I know they were sick to death of travelling around in a real estate agent's car because there was no such thing as internet then.
No.
The only advantage was that when we got to a place, they liked to play with other kids' toys when we went in and had a look at a property. And they got to travel in an air-conditioned car. The agent was usually horrified at these three little kids sitting in the back munching on rusks.
And have they followed suit, Janet?
Yes, they have, actually. Yeah. Yes. They're all in their 30s now.
Yeah.
And for some of them, it took a little while to catch on. But they've all got it. Yeah. They've, what you say, of, they've got it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I understand it now.
Yes.
So
in a very balanced way.
Yeah. So money doesn't drive you then. So what does drive you? Obviously, keeping active and fit. But what's the why for you? Why do you get out of bed these days?
I think just the pleasure of living and living in a way that I want to. I try to live a healthy life. I try to stay active. I want to go to France this year again. I've already organised a walking holiday in the Pyrenees. So enjoying life to its maximum. And a little bit of money along the way does help that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's very easy to say, well, I'm happy and I don't have anything, but I'd like to go to the French Pyrenees and I like to fly business class there. But when I get there, I'm very happy to stay in a $20 a night mountain hut, thanks very much, mm-hmm. without a shower. Mm. So it's the act of living, I think, that drives me in a way that money has allowed me to live. Mm. Sometimes it's luxurious and sometimes it's not.
Mm. Mm.
But there's a balance.
You have a wealth of knowledge, so I'm keen to understand.
All right, folks, this is Bryce here. Just wanted to quickly let you know that there was so much great information that we got from Jan Summers while she was on the couch that we've split it into two parts. So this is the end of the first part, but don't despair. You can listen to the second part straight away because she's got some really great stuff to share. So we'll see you on part two.